It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up on Central Time, we'll try to find out why you need to understand its waterways if you want to understand the history of Milwaukee. First, Boy Scouts president and former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates called for an end to the Boy Scouts ban on gay scout leaders. He was speaking at the organization's national annual meeting in Atlanta. Here's what he had to say.
I remind you of the recent debates we have seen in Indiana, in Arkansas, and elsewhere over discrimination based on sexual orientation, not to mention the impending U.S. Supreme Court decision on gay marriage. I'm not asking the National Board for any action to change our current policy at this meeting, but I must speak as plainly and as bluntly to you as I spoke to presidents when I was Director of CIA and Secretary of Defense. We must deal with the world as it is, not as we might wish it would be. The status quo in our movement's membership standards cannot be sustained.
In 2013, the Boy Scouts voted to allow openly gay boys to join the organization, but the debate over whether to give the okay to openly gay scout leaders has continued to be contentious. Eric Eckholm joins us now. He's national legal correspondent at the New York Times. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much.
So listening to that clip of Robert Gates' speech there, you get the sense that he isn't necessarily making this announcement, this urging for moral reasons, but that he wants the Boy Scouts to be in step with the times, with the way that the winds are blowing politically right now in this country. How did you read that statement?
Yes, well, I think it's more than that. He fears that if they don't sort of get control of this issue, get out of ahead of things, that it could almost destroy the Scouts. There are a lot of internal divisions over this and an emerging threat of lawsuits in a number of states, which could really do a lot of damage. So, I think he tried to put it in the most blunt, practical terms for the people listening, for whom this has been, this issue has been a very divisive one for many years for the Scouts.
Can you give us a sense how he wanted this decision to be implemented?
Well, they have, he's actually a volunteer as president, but the Scouts are ruled by volunteers, basically. There's an executive council of 60 or 70 people, nearly all of them kind of prominent community leaders who volunteer. And that board can decide on its own, or it could open the issue to a general meeting of Scout leaders from around the country. That's what they did in 2013, when they decided to allow openly gay boys in the Scouts. They had a vote, and they got something like 60% of the vote. And that actually led some extremely conservative religious people in Scouts to leave and form their own organization. This time, I think a lot of people think probably the executive board sometime in the coming year, or maybe even very soon, will decide to implement this policy, because the legal problems are pressing on them, as he stressed in his speech.
And a lot of Boy Scout troops are sponsored by churches. Do we know how many?
Yes, more than half are sponsored by churches. By far the biggest one is the Mormon Church, but the Roman Catholic churches and various Protestant denominations sponsor a lot of Boy Scout troops. And some of those churches, especially the Mormons, the Roman Catholics, and some of the evangelical churches, are very much against acknowledging gay behavior and in any way giving rights or leadership roles to gay people in their organizations. So this is why it's such a difficult issue for the Boy Scouts. They don't want to lose all those members. I mean, something like one-fifth of all Scout troops are sponsored by the Mormon Church. So that's why the policy announced, well, not the policy, his proposal was that we relax the national ban, but we allow local groups that control Scout troops to make their own decisions on this.
So then what happens if a local troop takes up the issue and decides not to allow openly gay scout leaders? Is there still a legal issue then?
Well, that will depend on the state and the city. Again, as he acknowledged, a lot of states now, or something, nearly half the states have laws forbidding employment discrimination based on sexual orientation. and even more cities have it in states that might not have it statewide. So, for example, in New York and Colorado, they might have. There are cases already where they might have faced legal action by the state or a lawsuit. And so, I guess in a state that has that kind of law, even if the National Boy Scouts didn't get involved, someone could bring a suit. And so, this issue is far from over.
We're talking right now about yesterday's announcement by the president of the Boy Scouts urging the group to acknowledge the changing times and allow gay scout leaders. Eric Eckholm from the New York Times is with us now. And Eric, what specific concerns have kept the Boy Scouts from allowing gay scout leaders in the past?
Well, historically, as with much of the country and many institutions, there was never really a thought given to the issue. And then maybe in the last 20 years, as it began to percolate, there was initially a conservative reaction. I mean, there always have been some gay scouts and some gay leaders. There was a Supreme Court case in the year 2000, which the Boy Scouts won, saying that they could not be required to allow gay members. But the pressures grew and grew, more and more local, in more liberal parts of the country, local scout troops and groups were complaining and defying it. So it came to a head 2 years ago, and in May of 2013, they decided to allow boys, openly gay boys, but it was just at that time considered too sensitive or too divisive to address the issue of leaders and adults. Again, it's because of, I think, mainly this concern that large swaths of the Boy Scouts that are sponsored by more conservative religions might just quit and really decimate the Boy Scouts.
In reading your piece, it also sounded like there was a strand of resistance to this where some scout members in leadership thought that having gay men in proximity to boys on sleepovers was something they were uncomfortable with.
Well, there are some people that definitely feel that way, and I'm sure there are some parents around the country that might not allow their kid to be in a troop that was led by a gay leader. I think the statistics really show that that's not a completely valid concern, that sexual abuse is not confined to gay leaders, openly gay leaders, and the scouts have other protections. I mean, they got hit with a lot of lawsuits because of abuses in the past, and now they have policies that leaders should not be alone with boys and other things. So, as with many other areas of life, they'll be feeling their way ahead here.
Do you have a sense of how some of the churches involved in the Boy Scouts are responding so far? The Mormon Church you mentioned and the Roman Catholic Church.
Yes. There's been no real public response. The Mormon Church just said, we're studying it. I haven't seen anything from Catholics. I'm sure there are some people who are very angry or disappointed, but again, the policy, the proposal that he made gives them an out, that if it's again, if the local sponsor, the local church wants to choose certain kinds of leaders, they can do that. And so there are future battles to be fought, but there's nothing in what he proposed that I would think that would drive them away right now, but they might, see there's a trend that they don't like. But these institutions are changing as well. I mean, when they decided to allow gay boys to be in the Scouts, there was a lot of fear that the Mormon Church would withdraw at that time, but they didn't. They said, fine, we can live with that policy. So it remains to be seen.
Now, the Boy Scouts have seen a decline in membership, it seems like, for decades. Is there a sense that perhaps a move like this could help to reverse that?
That's what they're hoping. I mean, ever since about 1970, the membership has declined a few percent each year. And, it's hard in a more urban society and where kids are into electronic things. They've struggled to be relevant. So they now have merit badges and things like animation and it goes way beyond the traditional camping and first aid. But they clearly lost some extremely conservative families over this issue, but they're hoping that perhaps more, that others might, who might have stayed away because they didn't like the discrimination, might join now.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Eric Eckholm, New York Times national legal correspondent, about Boy Scout President Robert Gates' call to end the ban on gay scout leaders. You can add to the discussion over on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. If you've lived in Wisconsin for even a couple of years, chances are you've spent time admiring the lakefront in Milwaukee or strolling along Milwaukee's riverways. Well, our next guest says Milwaukee isn't just a city that happens to have great access to the water. It's literally on the map because of its water. John Gerda joins us now. He's a Milwaukee historian and the host and writer of the public television documentary Milwaukee, a City Built on Water. John, welcome to Central Time.
Glad to be here, Veronica.
Well, why do you think that we need to understand water, the lakes, the rivers, if we really want to understand the history of Milwaukee?
Because they are the motive force for Milwaukee settlement, not just Milwaukee's. I mean, water was the reason that most inland settlements were created as well. But in Milwaukee's case, the reason Milwaukee exists is because it had the best natural harbor on the western shore of Lake Michigan. So back in those days, all the way from the Chicago River in Chicago up to the Pike in Kenosha, the Root and Racine, Manitowoc and Manitowoc, up and down the Lake Michigan shoreline, all those cities came to life at river mouths that had harbor potential. So really, Milwaukee is built on water in that sense. And in a literal sense, most of what is now central Milwaukee was a wetland in the early years, and that was filled in. So what you think of as much of downtown, the Third Ward, Walker's Point, pieces of Bayview, the Menominee Valley, that was all wetland. So the some major landmarks were literally built on water.
Right. Didn't you say that the name Milwaukee seems likely to mean wetland in a Native American language?
No one really knows. They didn't leave a dictionary behind. You know, there wasn't. The Native Americans didn't weren't evicted and they left a dictionary in their hogans. But there's one theory is that it could mean wetland, and others that it means good land. And the good land, obviously, is, you know, a lot of that was the water resource was so important. So both work.
So let's look at the port aspect of this in the port of Milwaukee. How did that influence Milwaukee's place on the map?
In the 1830s, 40s, 50s, 60s, those first decades of settlement in Milwaukee, the port was not just Milwaukee's front door, but it was the economic engine. By the early 1860s, because of all the railroads that Milwaukee interests had sent to the north and west, you had just this cascade of grain, especially wheat, pouring in from throughout Wisconsin and neighboring states into and through Milwaukee. So by the early 1860s, Milwaukee was the largest shipper of wheat on the planet. And that was a title that was kind of passed around among other Great Lakes cities, including Chicago. But Milwaukee was really a player there. And that was absolutely an outcome of having an excellent port.
And it sounds like all along water wasn't just beauty, it wasn't just recreation, but it meant jobs and industry to those early Milwaukee area people. How did they use water to make a living?
Early on, it was hydropower. So you have dams at the Milwaukee River and the Menominee River, not the Kinnickinnick, that was too small, but you have mills that drove turbines that ground flour and saw lumber and made textiles and paper. So the fact that there was at least a modest drop in those rivers was really important to having industry locate in the first place. And then it was process water for doing everything from tanning hides to making beer, most obviously, also cooling machinery. But it was a plentiful source of good water that was indispensable for the brewers who made their homes in Milwaukee way back in the 1840s is when they began.
And you've uncovered a lot of cool history related to water in the area that I had no idea. You say that at one point the Upper Milwaukee River was a sort of in town up north around 1900.
Yeah, my favorite part of the documentary, and this is the hour-long Built on Water documentary that Wisconsin I did in cooperation with Milwaukee Public TV. My favorite segment is I think it's about 8 minutes, and it's called River Recreation. And from the North Avenue Dam all the way up almost to Capitol Drive, the river was lined with beer gardens, canoe clubs, swimming schools, amusement parks, private summer homes, people who went all the way out to what's current now Kern Park, which is 2 miles from downtown. That was their summer place. It went all the way out into the country. And we got some wonderful photographs, just some really evocative photographs. And we found in the Milwaukee Public Schools Recreation Division archives a film of a winter carnival that was held back in 1917. And it shows everything from dog sled to a genuine ski jump to my favorite part, which is a couple of kind of inventors in Milwaukee took the front wheel off a bike and welded a skate blade, an ice skate blade, to the fork, so they had what we called an icicle. And they actually had, then the inventor's son, when he saw the documentary, called or sent an email, and he said, that was my dad, and we still have one. So there's actually an ice bike still in existence, but just wonderful footage.
Yeah. I'm surprised that hasn't taken off in a way here in Wisconsin, the icicle.
Well, there was a flurry when the documentary premiered on Earth Day, April 22nd, a flurry of emails and phone calls about, can we make one of those? Can we kind of reverse engineer the one that still exists? And so who knows? You may be seeing those on a lake near you.
We're talking right now with John Gerda, Milwaukee historian, also host and writer of the public television documentary with Wisconsin Eyes called Milwaukee, a City Built on Water. And another bit of hidden history here. South of downtown was a place called Jones Island, mm-hmm. which sounds like a thriving fishing village peopled by immigrants from Poland.
That's right.
What did they do there?
One of the things that history teaches you is that nothing was inevitable, and though there can be just incredible transformations. If you look at Jones Island today, it's the port of Milwaukee. It's the sewage treatment plant. There are what they call tank farms for petroleum products and the Dan Hone Expressway Bridge. So no one lives there, absolutely no one. It's kind of an urban wilderness. But from the 1870s to the 1920s, that was a fishing village of roughly 1,600 people from the Baltic Sea coast of Poland. There's kind of a subgroup called the Kashubes. My grandmother was Kashub. And they were fisher people, fisher folk in the old country, and where most of their countrymen and women, when they came to America, they had to take industrial jobs. The Kashubes kept on fishing. So they would bring up 2 million pounds of fish in a typical year, and that was Milwaukee's main source of kind of fish protein, and they would sell it door-to-door, they'd sell it wholesale, they'd smoke it, there were fish fries, so there really was an extremely busy and prosperous fishing colony down there, and there were also at one time 11 saloons on Jones Island, so that's something Claudia Luz was the producer and director for the documentary, and we're talking about pitching the idea of a documentary just on Jones Island and doing that in the next year or two. That could be a lot of fun. It's just it's the closest thing Wisconsin has ever had, and perhaps the Midwest, to a genuine urban village right in the heart of town, but a very rural way of life.
If you were to visit Jones Island today, could you see any of the old buildings or evidence of what was once there?
Nothing. No, all you see, Veronica, is there's on the west side is a little park called Kashub's Park. And it's probably about the size of your studio. It's the smallest park in Milwaukee. And all that's there is a picnic bench, an anchor, and some kind of nice floral plantings. And there's every year for the last probably 15 or 20, there's been a reunion down there in early August of Kashub descendants. Now no one is still living who live there, but their kids and grandkids are still around. So no, there is no there is nothing left of that period. And what happened was the city condemned the land for both the sewage treatment plant and for the outer harbor, and so it was completely remade. Most of what's Jones Island today is landfill.
Now, looking at a darker period for the lakes, the lower Milwaukee River, pretty much an open sewer by the 1900s. Lake Michigan itself had big problems. Now we're seeing invasive species. There was a lot of degradation to Lake Michigan in that era as well. But you're seeing a turning point now. What are you seeing in terms of the revitalization and the cleaning up of Milwaukee's water?
It's been really encouraging. The Milwaukee River had almost a Jekyll and Hyde personality. Above the dam, it was the water recreation. Below the dam, it was industry and incredible pollution. There's in the documentary, there's some really colorful prose about Yellowish Murky Stream and odor combined of the effluvia of 100 sewers. It was just a cesspool. what happened was that since the Clean Water Act was passed back in 1972, Milwaukee put the Deep Tunnel Project in, the water's gotten a whole lot cleaner. So back in the 20s, there was actually a serious proposal to turn the Milwaukee River below the dam into a grand boulevard, to kind of deck it and turn it to a box sewer, basically. You know, kind of. So now there is a river walk along both banks that runs for about 2 miles, and you can canoe it, kayak it, powerboat it, many places to stop for a drink or stop for dinner. And in the summertime, people are just, they flock to the river. So there has been just a dramatic turnaround, and that's been really hopeful. And above, a little bit farther upstream, North Avenue Dam, there are really pricey condos. So it's become a place where people want to both recreate and live again. The Blake, on the other hand, you know, that in some ways things have improved. We used to dump garbage in the lake, as other cities did, and the water has gotten somewhat cleaner, but the invasive species have just done, they've just wreaked havoc.
And we have to leave it there. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Veronica.
That was John Gerda, Milwaukee historian and writer and host of Milwaukee, A City Built on Water. You can screen it online at mptv.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is off today. As we head into Memorial Day weekend on Monday and the unofficial start of summer, we decided to focus on grilling for this Food Friday. Our guest says that at its core, grilling is simple, but he has lots of advice, techniques, and recipes to share that could take your grilling to the next level. David Guas is a chef at Bayou Bakery, Coffee Bar, and Eatery in Washington, D.C., and the host of the Travel Channel's American Grilled. He's also the author of the book Grill Nation, 200 Surefire Recipes, Tips and Techniques to Grill Like a Pro. David, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. What's going on?
We're getting ready for Memorial Day weekend, just like you. This is the perfect way to springboard into that. I imagine lots of people firing up the grill. And
That's right.
Maybe reliving memories. You write that grilling has a lot of family memories for you, and I'm sure you're not alone. Why do you think that grilling is kind of a special thing to do like that?
You know, I think that that's just food in general, but specifically for me, outside, it was about, you know, connecting with my dad. You know, weekend guy. He was a, you know, Monday through Friday work professional, had his own office, and was a veterinarian. So Saturday, and if he didn't have surgeries on Saturday, Saturday and Sunday was his time to sort of kick back and fire up the grill and kind of not watch the clock the whole day, and it was a way to sort of escape. And, you know, he allowed me to kind of enter that world and be his assistant and ask a lot of questions like kids do. And that was the way we sort of connected on the weekends, among other things. But grilling was definitely part of that for us.
A lot of people doing that as families this weekend. And you open your book by saying that really grilling is simple. On the other hand, you've got charcoal grills, you've got gas grills, you've got different kinds of wood chips. So how do you make the case that grilling is simple?
Well, you know, for me, it's about reminding people that you don't have to complicate it. There's many levels of it. So once you get into it, as far as an entry level, it can be a very simple process. You're talking about fire. You're talking about a heat source. You're talking about, you know, making sure that a couple things that I tell people right off the bat is make sure that you have direct heat and indirect heat capability. So if you're using a gas grill, it would be more of not turning all four burners on, maybe, and giving yourself an area to within the grill to be able to sort of put your proteins or your vegetables or whatever you're grilling off to the side. In the case of flare-ups, or if you're exposing it to too much heat, you want to be able to sort of maybe continue to cook it through, but not over direct flame. And same with the charcoal. Charcoal, we always talk about sort of piling up the charcoal and creating a zone. Zone your charcoal, so maybe only a third of your grill was occupied by the actual charcoal, and then you've got plenty of space to sort of put your item off to the side to give it some rest while it continues to cook through. And so if you follow a couple of those sort of basic things, you know, there's no reason to panic.
Well, let's start with the setup. Since you're the grill master here, what do you recommend for, you know, like the optimal grill to use, and what equipment do you need?
You know, some basic things, obviously, you know, it really is a preference thing. So if you're a charcoal guy like or a gal like myself, you know, I would recommend just sort of one of those barrel type of grills, and or, you know, Weber's are great. Obviously Green Eggs. So there's the list is pretty large now, and so a lot to choose from. The more you grill, the more you'll kind of learn the grill's personality, and really it's going to become reflective of kind of your style and your personality. So I always tell people to grill on other people's grills for a while before they invest too much into a grill that, you know, may not be for them. Do research. You know, the internet's great. Plenty of information out there. And then, you know, some simple tools, some extended tongs, some long extended spatula. A chimney starter is great for being able to fire up your coals pretty quickly. If you're an impatient griller like myself, you know, you want to get one of those chimney starters, pile up the charcoal and light a little newspaper underneath it, and about 15, 20 minutes later, you're ripping to go. And then, you know, if you like to play around with the wood, you want to make sure you have some wood chips or chunks around. I'm a big fan of three or four different types. I use pecan and apple and cherry, and then I love, you know, some hickory, and I usually blend some of those together. So a lot of people tell me, you know, they ask me what I like to use as far as wood, and I really just kind of mishmash it together. Apple, I try to stay in the pork range, you know, pecans and things like that. I'll do with some meats, some red meats and things like that, and maybe some poultry. So, you know, it's kind of never-ending. But, again, some simple tools to get started. It doesn't have to really be a very expensive way to get into grilling.
We definitely have to get to the food, but I want to ask you, I have a gas grill at home. It's what we use. How do you incorporate wood chips with a gas grill?
Well, it depends on what kind of grill you do have. Some of them have these sort of auto pellets that sort of it will add a certain amount of the pellets to the grill almost on a timer. So these grills have become smarter than we have and really have sort of taken on, you know, a whole different realm of amenities, options, and things like that. Well, I'll put, you know, a pan at the bottom of the grill and add a little bit of water to it, and I can put some chips inside of the water. I can also, just use that sort of base of that gas grill to be able to sort of create a little bit of smoke. So I'll put water separately, and then I'll put some chips in a separate little pan at the base of the belly of the grill itself, and you'll be able to sort of create some smoke flavor from that.
Okay, great. Some good ideas there. Well, let's talk about, you know, this is sort of your basics, your square one, your sauces. You say you've got to have your sauces going on, and you've got a lot of them in your cookbook. What do you recommend? What's your favorite here for a good starter?
You know, there's some really easy ones that don't require a lot of ingredients, you know, some ketchup-based type of sauces and things like that. You know, I got to play around with a bunch of different ones. My dad was kind of the sauce guy, none of his sauces were ever quite exact. So one day he might make one a little differently with some added spices. To me, you know, you want to start with an acid. You want to have a ketchup base, and then maybe a little Worcestershire and some seasonings, salt and pepper. Obviously, some sweetness, either coming from brown sugar. I love honey and what honey does in the sauce. It really helps to lacquer and create a lot of great mahogany color on the grill. Plus, using honey really sort of helps to absorb sort of the smoke flavor, in my opinion, a little bit more so than some other sweeteners. But again, you know, brown sugar works great, honey, also cane syrup, sorghum. So those type of natural syrups are wonderful to sort of blend. And of course, some additional acid, either coming from white vinegar or cider vinegar and things like that. So if you kind of start with those three or four things, you know, the seasoning part of it can be really a personal thing. You can, you know, add a little heat by adding a little cayenne, or you can play around with some chipotle peppers and things like that if you want more of a smokier type of sauce. So, yeah, that's the way I go.
And you've got a couple if you really want to mix it up a little, don't go for the barbecue sauce. You've got an Asian seafood marinade. And what's in that one?
The Asian seafood marinade?
Yeah.
The sauces are, you know, really about, I'm going to try to think real quick.
Looks like some sesame oil and some lime juice and some brown sugar.
Yeah, it's you know, it's about a region, so you're sort of matching up different ingredients with your particular region, and so when you stay in that region, you know, you're really helping to, you know, invoke that area. So with the lime and other flavors like soy and things like that, and a little bit of sweetness coming from sugars, that really sort of helps to bring it all together.
And you've also got some surprising things in here like that one. You've got a recipe for grilled oysters. Can oysters really be grilled?
Oh, yeah. Coming from New Orleans, that was one of the signature dishes of New Orleans and still is today. There's something called a charbroiled oyster, and it's these beautiful Louisiana oysters that are large enough to cut with a steak knife. Some of them are massive, like big old ribeyes, and that really lends itself to the grill. And we'd crack them open on the half shell, and then we'd make a garlic butter, and we would sort of allow that to sort of be ladled over the top of the open half-shell oyster right on the grill. And what happens is some of that butter kind of falls off to the side and runs through the shell, it'll spark a flare-up on your grill and really sort of create a smokiness. And that oyster literally will start bubbling in its own shell. And just as it starts to curl the edges, we usually pull it right off the grill because you want them to kind of still be moist and tender and not dry out.
Oh, that sounds really good. I've never had one, but it sounds delicious.
It's fantastic.
Well, we've got a caller now. Let's take Bill joining us in Prescott. Hi, Bill.
Hello, and good afternoon. I've got a question for your guest in regards to a particular grill. It grills three ways: convection, radiation, and going to have to help me out with a third one there. There's only two manufacturers that I'm aware of. One is domestic. I'm not going to plug anybody, but it begins with the first initial T. And there's three syllables, and then there's a well-known Japanese.
Uh-huh. And what help do you need with it?
I need to source whether any of these are available in Wisconsin.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll see if we know. I don't know about that one. That sounds pretty fancy. What do you think about that, David? Are you familiar?
Well, I don't know the specific brands and manufacturers, but I will say that on our show on the Travel Channel, the American Grill Show, that I played host on, we actually had kind of one of those hybrid style grills, and you know, they were interesting. We had the gas aspect of it, of a sort of a traditional gas grill. There was a sort of a high heat radiant temperature burner that was almost like a broiler. It really had intense heat on one side, and then had a little bit of a smoker kind of aspect on the other side. And it was great for the show because it allowed people three different sort of ways to prepare things and gave you a little bit more surface area than traditionally. You know, this particular one was not heavy duty, and you know, I kind of, as much as I love my grills, I really work them over pretty good. So I would make sure that, you know, you're sourcing something that's got a good gauge steel and is made with you know, a high quality thick you know, type of metal, so that you can, you know, time after time you're gonna, you know, have that grill at a certain temperature. So you really want to make sure that you're not getting something too cheap.
We're talking right now with grill expert David Gloss about his new book. It's called Grill Nation, talking on this Food Friday. And we're taking your calls. What are you planning to grill up for Memorial Day? Do you have a favorite go-to recipe, a technique, a sauce, or maybe a question for our guests about mixing it up with some of the usual burgers and brats? He's got some ideas there, too. You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our chat about grilling on this Food Friday with David Gloss. He's a chef and author of the new cookbook, Grill Nation. And we're taking your calls right now. Want to know what you're grilling up this weekend? If you have some questions about grilling technique or recipes, we've got a lot that we can focus on here. Chicken and pork and burgers. We're going to get to some of that along with a recipe for peach glazed pork chops. You can call up, ask our expert at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And David, let's get to that recipe you gave us, peach glazed pork chops. What goes into that one?
You know, it's starting right off the bat with the peach preserve. So, you know, something that you generally will have in your pantry. And so when you start with something like that has the pectin and sort of jellifying agent already in it, you're really going to already have that sort of nice opportunity to get a sort of a coating or a glaze. And so it's countered with the soy, so it's not so sweet, and that ginger just really brightens everything up and gives it a little heat. So it's just a wonderful, simple sauce that, again, doesn't require a lot of ingredients.
Sounds great. And that one is up right now on our Central Time Facebook page. And we're going to go to a caller now. Dan is joining us from Harvard, Illinois. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I had a question about something to give a good smoke flavor. I recently bought one of the smokers, but I found that it seems like all the smoking recipes in the smoker take too long. So do you have any recommendations for something that doesn't quite take quite as long on the smoker, or something that you can grill, a good way to grill and get the smoke flavor?
Sure. I love smoking salmon, you know, just a fresh salmon fillet, getting, you know, a side of you know, Atlantic salmon or whatever type of salmon that's sort of in your area. And, you know, an oilier fish like that has a lot of flavor does not require a lot of smoking time. I will get my grill really hot. You know, sometimes I used to soak my wood chips and chunks, and now I don't. A good friend of mine, Danielle, they call her Diva Q. She's on the barbecue circuit. She's sort of, you know, denounce that sort of technique, and so I'm kind of been playing back and forth with soaking my wood and not soaking it. So I use chunks versus chips. They tend to release a little bit slower. So if you want something a little faster, go ahead and use the chips as opposed to the chunks. So something a little finer with your wood. And then once your salmon's on, you know, get a really hot grill so you don't stick. And we'll bring it to about a medium rare and sprinkle the chips into my grill and lit it and literally shut my dampers down. And all it needs is about 3 to 4 minutes to finish up. And it's amazing how quickly the fish will pick up the smoke. So that really goes for a lot of fish, grouper and snapper and salmon and trout, bronzino, all those type of fish really just sort of play with that smoke really, really nicely, and it doesn't require a lot of time.
Sounds good. All right. Thanks for the call, Dan. Appreciate that. And we have an open line for you at 800-642-1234 as we get ready for some Memorial Day grilling. And David, in the book, you've got a big section on chicken and one feature, sweet tea. Now, I know sweet tea is a big thing in the South. What does it do to chicken?
You know, it's going to give you a certain color. You know, most of those teas that we use for sweet tea, whatever brand it may be for you, is a black tea. And it just gives it sort of a depth and a sort of an herbal aspect and undertone, which is just really nice with poultry.
And do you have any other recommendations like that where you can use it on other meats?
Yeah, I mean, really it's delicate enough that it really only works with the poultry, you know, so guinea hen or guinea fowl and squab and quail and chicken, you know, a duck as well works quite nicely. I haven't tinkered with the with other proteins with it, but I can imagine that pork might work nicely as well, but definitely not really a red meat kind of pairing. So I would stay away from playing around with a big old ribeye and sweet tea.
Well, before we let you go, we got to talk a little bit about sort of your staples, your burgers, your hot dogs, your brats. What do you recommend for taking your typical burger and doing it well, not getting one that's not dried out, not charred on one side, but maybe also fancying it up a little?
Yeah, well, you know, perfect example of dressing something up that, you know, what I consider sometimes a little boring, your typical sort of turkey burger. We do one called the Feathered Fez, and it's a riff off of kind of the Mediterranean. Again, talking about sort of staying regional with your ingredients. My wife doesn't eat beef or pork, and so we cook a lot of turkey in the house. We have to wait till she goes out of town to get out the big red meats. But this is just a simple application combination, a little Worcestershire and a little salt on the outside of the patties, but really the showstopper are the sort of the toppings. So, you know, cooking it all the way through, obviously with turkey, going for the thigh meat, you know, more flavor versus the breast. Breasts tend to dry out a little bit more. If you're worried about the fat content, buy a pound of each and blend them yourselves. So once these are grilled to 165 degrees internal temperature, we dress it up with this really nice olive tapenade kind of mayonnaise. Very simple, some baby spinach, tomatoes, maybe some grilled portobello mushrooms and some crumbled feta. It's a very exciting burger all of a sudden because of all these fun toppings and ingredients, and also because of all those grilled vegetables and the lettuce. You know, it really adds additional moisture to the finished burger. So kind of fun and definitely a home run with the flavors.
Yeah, that sounds great. And another one that caught my eye, you know, you got your typical hot dog, but this one had, I think it had sriracha sauce on it, and it was also brined or marinated in beer for a while. How does that go down?
Well, you know, it's, again, talking about what sriracha does, you know, you've got that sort of acidity and that sort of sharpness with the vinegar, it's just a wonderful way to sort of balance of that. So we've got a little bit of mayonnaise and the whole grain mustard, and we make that sauce together and sort of almost like not a deconstructed, but kind of a cabbage and pickle relish topping. You know, for me, it's really about, you know, sort of having fun. That's an easy way to sort of play with different flavors is with a hot dog, you know, throwing them on the grill. You don't have to smoke them, throwing a little smoke on there, but being very creative with the toppings was an easy thing for me, and also just a lot of fun.
And David, in our last seconds here, what are you going to grill this weekend?
That is a great question. I will be at my restaurant pretty much all weekend that we just opened up, but I can tell you I'm going to try to fire it up this weekend and definitely get some andouille on there, and I also have some lamb necks in the freezer from a good friend of mine in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and I'm probably going to make a little chimichurri and be able to sort of snack on those lamb necks.
Wow, sounds adventurous. Well, have a yummy Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, you do as well, and thanks so much, and happy grilling, everybody.
Thanks a lot. Well, that was David Guas. He is chef at Bayou Bakery, Coffee Bar, and Eatery in Washington, D.C., and host of the Travel Channel's American Grilled, the author of the new book, Grill Nation, 200 Surefire Recipes, Tips, and Techniques to Grill Like a Pro. And now a news that makes us feel really old, well, at least Gen Xers like me, the video game Pac-Man turns 35 years old today. In case you forgot, this is a game from the 80s where the big yellow dot with a giant mouth gobbles up the little dots and runs away from ghosts. It's a lot like life, really, when you think about it. And there's a big party for that game tonight in Chicago where a guy named Billy Mitchell will play anyone who wants to challenge him at Pac-Man, but they better think twice because Billy Mitchell, also the first person to ever get a perfect score at Pac-Man. I'm kind of more of a Galaga person myself, but I have played my share of Pac-Man. A couple months ago, we had to pull off the road in Kentucky in a tiny, tiny town where in a pizza parlor place next to the freeway was a genuine old-school Pac-Man game, which, of course, ended up doing exactly what Pac-Man games usually do these days. It ate my quarters. Well, we go out to the news now with the early 80s hit, Pac-Man Fever.